From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Donald Trump's propensity for fascism has long been undeniable. He's expressed open admiration for dictatorial figures and fantasized out loud about repressive tactics against his detractors. Now the city of Portland, Oregon has become a flashpoint, with federal officers known to be affiliated with the Department of Homeland Security being deployed to repress Black Lives Matter protests. There are numerous documented instances of protesters being attacked, maimed, tear-gassed, and arrested without charges or documentation. Trump has openly admired the Gestapo-like tactics and dismissed concerns, saying those being targeted are simply anarchists who, quote, hate our country. The White House has pointed to other cities like Chicago and Milwaukee, where the use of federal officers could be expanded. We go now to Portland to speak with Shane Burley. He's a writer and filmmaker, and his work has appeared in such publications as The Daily Beast, Roar Magazine, In These Times, Labor Notes, and more. He's also the author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. Welcome to the program, Shane.
Thanks for having me back on.
So let's first talk about how it was that it even came to be known that these federal officers were being documented very closely. When they first appeared, nobody knew who they were affiliated with, and then it became apparent that they were affiliated with DHS. But it was, as you point out in your article, recent article that you wrote, it was the work of really independent journalists that have documented exactly who these officers are and what they're up to?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're talking about federal officers. They're not local officers. They're basically sent in under an executive order from Trump to protect monuments and federal buildings. And so they're coming in. And there had been escalation from the police for weeks and weeks. That's the Portland police in Portland, who were charged with attacking protesters and suppressing journalists. And there ended up being a number of lawsuits and injunctions to stop some of their behavior. And so it actually kind of backed off a little bit. But then federal officers showed up who aren't playing by those rules and basically ramped up the escalated violence again. People didn't know why they were there exactly. And then eventually it came out that they were federal officers. And then what's happening on the ground is that a lot of kind of staff reporters, the publications don't have the budgets to keep people there. So there's just these like citizen reporters or independent journalists who are on there filming people every night, who are on there documenting things, and they're capturing what the police are doing, how they're handling protesters. They're the people, capturing things like protesters getting snatch and grab, basically just picked up by these soldier appearing officers and shoved into vans and driven away. So basically what we're seeing and what we're about the kind of violent nature of the federal officers is being known because there's lots of people on the ground who are there every night, spending all night at a lot of personal risk to safety, oftentimes not getting paid and documenting it.
And it was the injury of one particular protester named Donovan Labella, who was struck in the head by one of these so-called non-lethal munitions that brought attention to what was being done, and also prompted local officials to take a stand. And this particular instance was also documented by independent journalists, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a lot of cameras running at any given time across the street. So it's worthwhile understanding the geography. There's the Justice Center, the Federal Justice Center. Across the street is a series of parks where demonstrations often happen. People are in the parks protesting. The officers are across the street. They start firing munitions over. It hits a protester who's holding a sign directly in the head. He collapses. It shatters his skull. Medics have to carry him out. And this is all captured on video. And it's very clear that this is a peaceful protester standing there with a sign. He's recovering, but very serious condition. These are very serious traumatic brain injury. And this is not uncommon for what they're doing now. So for example, I was reporting down there on Friday night, and before a public event that had, politicians speaking and local community leaders and stuff, before it even finished, a line of what appear to be troops, but they are federal officers dressed in fatigues with weapons, come in, line up, and start firing so much tear gas and munitions that it literally clears out several square city blocks. And when I say tear gas, people sometimes think that we're talking about a little bit in the air to kind of make it unattractive. I'm talking about dozens of tear gas canisters coming in simultaneously, creating a no-go zone for the entire city area. So we're talking about incredibly aggressive, No warnings, no provocation, just coming in and clearing things out.
We know that such type of weapons are really incompatible with the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, this can make people more susceptible to the virus. So some have pointed out that these are the tactics by the same kinds of officers that have long been deployed to other cities to target undocumented immigrants, and that, you know, had a wider swath of Americans spoken out against how DHS has been targeting undocumented immigrants, rounding them up, disappearing them, that maybe we wouldn't be in this position today.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a reminder that people should always be looking to where the vanguard of police violence and state violence actually is coming from, and that there's always a material benefit to speaking up and standing in solidarity. Once they start at one community, they expand that out, and they make lots of people a target. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that these tactics were honed on communities of color, and they're now being extended to Black Lives Matter protesters and progressive protesters around the country.
Among the people that were brutalized just in the past few days was a Navy veteran who, you know, he's a very tall man, but he's a disabled veteran, walked into this group of officers, and apparently he wanted to just talk to them, and they just began beating him with batons. And it wasn't until he was pepper sprayed right in the face that he was sort of being forced to walk away. Do you know anything about this particular instance? And you know, he doesn't fit this profile that Trump wants people to buy of being, you know, an anarchist who hates the country.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't there for that particular instance, but this is a common situation. There's a lot of people out there. I mean, one of the things is that Trump is trying to portray this as some kind of militant communist or anarchist insurgency happening. And of course, there's radicals there. There's radicals in every social movement. They're a big part of the social movement. There's also everyday folks. So, for example, there was a line of moms there this weekend who were also attacked with tear gas. A number of community leaders. We're talking about veterans. We're talking about older people. We're talking about anti-war activists. There's lots of people that are there trying to lend a voice and stand with Black lives, and they are being attacked with such a blanket use of force. Example also is that people letting the police know that they are journalists and that they're standing aside to document what's happening, that has no effect on it, whatever. So that's one of the things I think is so frightening to people about the federal officers is that, you know, Portland officers, as brutal as they have been, they are essentially from Portland or the areas around Portland. They're, I mean, at least nominally accountable to state official stuff. These people have no accountability to anyone locally. They don't care if people don't like what they're doing. They don't care if there's an insurgency against them. They're there under Trump's orders to fulfill a certain thing, and they aren't sharing their rules of engagement. They aren't announcing things. They're not doing press conferences. They're just attacking people at random. And, you know, in a number of these situations, they'll come in, spray tear gas everywhere, and then just leave, only to come back again in and out. So there's not a real clear understanding of why they're there, what they're trying to accomplish, or what people can do to be safe, even according to their orders.
So these officers are also, they've been documented having arrested people only to let them go, but not have any arrest records. There's no documentation. There's no paper trail of what their actions are. So it's caused a lot of people to say, well, how is this even legal? How is this even possible? But of course, you know, it was a couple of decades ago now nearly that Congress unanimously passed the USA Patriot Act, the formation of the Department of Homeland Security in the wake of the September 11th attacks, and Americans sort of tacitly accepted that these broad powers ought to be given to federal officers. Are we sort of seeing the predictable long-term results of that acceptance?
I think that we've had a lot of long-term acceptance about the overreach of federal officials, federal government. The 9/11 Patriot Act was a big part of that. I think that this is another step in that direction, and it's one that will continue if people allow it to continue. But again, you know, I talk to people at the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild. There's no situation in which grabbing people, violating their rights, not announcing who you are, just locking them in cells is legal. There's absolutely no situation in which that doesn't violate the law. And it should be notable that there is like lawsuits from the ACLU, right, and the Oregon Attorney General against the federal government right now. And likely those lawsuits are going to continue and escalate, and there's going to be individual lawsuits and things like that. I mean, every single piece of this is problematic. We're talking about Donald Trump basically making a partisan choice to send what basically are troops into a liberal city that snatch up protesters and lock them in cells. So there's no piece of this that shouldn't be frightening to people.
Right. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows just named, it seemed offhand, a few other cities where they were looking to expand the site, this type of federal official presence. And it was Chicago and Milwaukee, and taken together with Portland. These are all Democratic Party run cities. And of course, setting aside one's very legitimate critique of Democratic leadership in these cities, this is such a blatantly partisan power grab that it's kind of shocking. And, you know, it's also the kind of thing that Republican lawmakers often speak out against, but they seem to be silent now.
Yeah, apparently states' rights only really matter when you want to pass reactionary legislation.
Right, we're Senator Rand Paul on this, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I think what's notable about, for example, they're threatening right now to send federal officers into Chicago. But what's really important about that is why they're doing it. Just before that announcement was made, the president of the Fraternal Order of Police, the police union in Chicago, demanded that President Trump send in federal officers. Now they're doing it. There is a lot of connection between the federal officers and the local officers. There tends to be a lot of solidarity and bonding in Portland. They are working together. It's not just the federal officers doing this alone. And so I think there's the part of this is that Trump is waging a partisan war on liberal cities, also that he's doing it with the support of the police, and that there is a political alignment between Trump and the police departments, both at the federal level and locally.
Ken Cuccinelli, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, was interviewed just a few days ago by NPR. And, you know, it was really remarkable to see the way in which he avoided taking any responsibility. Basically, the only thing he did was admit that these were DHS officers. He said it was, you know, only in Portland. It hasn't been used anywhere else. And the whole point was to keep the officers safe and also move people to a safe location for questioning. And of course, the familiar standard justification of someone being identified who had assaulted officers. Now, I understand that the little bit of documentation that we have received of the supposed violence that these protesters are engaged in that's making them a target for these federal officers is graffiti. That's the extent of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think look at protester behavior and compare it to just the piles of police attacks that they've faced over the last few weeks. It's not even in the same ballpark. You know, one of the things that officials are doing right now is basically relying on red baiting and kind of radical fears to paint an excuse for federal officers, blaming things on anarchists, on Antifa. There's no evidence that any group or political affiliation is responsible for protests. In fact, these are huge, broad-based protests, usually led by communities of color. And so what this has done is meant to delegitimize the protest actions and make them seem as available candidates for the use of violence. It's supposed to dehumanize protesters. It's supposed to condition people to accept brutal violence against them. And it's the same thing about trumping up protester violence when it is minuscule in comparison to what's happening every night in Portland.
What about the local authorities? What about the mayor of Portland? What about the governor of the state? And of course, we also know that there are senators from the state, Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden, who are trying to attach an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act to address these federal officials, what Merkley referred to as paramilitaries. Do you think that there is a sufficiently strong response from officials?
I mean, I think officials are pretty uniform in not wanting them there and wanting the federal officers to leave. The mayor of Portland, Ted Wheeler, has said this much. He's also ostensibly the police commissioner. And so
right?
A lot of
yes.
people have said that he hasn't done enough at all to tamp down on police violence. And, you know, for him in an election year, this isn't voting well. His opponent is on the streets in the protest every night. And so I think that it definitely could be sharper. But at the same token, it's hard to say what they could do. They could, for example, try to bring in the National Guard and essentially declare civil war on the federal government. We're talking about a situation that has almost no precedent. We're talking about what essentially look like federal troops invading a state that they doesn't want them and having a complete clash between the federal government and the state.
Do you know of any instance where anybody's been able to communicate with these officers? I mean, I mentioned the Navy veteran who tried to speak with them. You know, you sort of have to wonder, looking back on this moment in history, these are men, and I think they're mostly men, who might wish they had chosen to not participate in this. I mean, we look at history, we look at, you know, Nazi troops, we look at how the rank and file of the fascist machine, you know, have sometimes stopped and spoken out or protested, but mostly participated because they've just gone along with it and haven't seen this in the context of history.
I mean, these officers are insulated from public opinion. They're not really there. Their careers don't really depend on the opinion of the people they're policing, which is inherently a problem right there. And the most communication people seem to get is them swearing and threatening them. And you know, so for example, like people, press trying to communicate that they are press and that they should be, you know, not attacked. And the police are telling them that they don't care, that they need to move anyway. And obviously using force first and command second. So I no one's been able to successfully communicate with the officers. No one really knows how to get access to them. They're not being interviewed by the press. The only thing that we're getting, you know, inflammatory statements from, like, you know, Acting Secretary Wolf and things like that. So that, I mean, that's the extent of it. And that's, I think, what part of what's so frightening to people is that there's a lot of unknowns. People don't know why protesters are being snatched off the street. People don't know why pure gas is being blanketed over, like, multiple square blocks simultaneously. People don't really understand what's happening and why.
Has it had a chilling effect on protests in Portland, or are people, you know, maybe being drawn out even more in defiance?
I think it has the potential to do some chilling effect, and I think it probably has had a chilling effect on some of the larger organizations and groups of people that might come to a more moderate event. But frankly, the behavior of federal officers and of the Portland police are solidifying the analysis that there's something systemically wrong with policing, and that police brutality is an essential feature of the policing model. And it's sort of making the case for the protesters who are advocating right now to defund the police and kind of using a model of decreasing the police budget by $50 million per year until they're able to transmit that money over to better state services. So, I mean, the argument is being made publicly by the police themselves. I think that is actually helping to keep the protests going. I think that if the police weren't brutalizing protesters every single night, that we wouldn't be hitting, you know, but day 53.
Right. They're basically making the protesters' point.
Nothing could be more of a pro-abolitionist propaganda than the behavior of the federal officers in Portland. Right.
I'm going back to this idea that the protesters are committing violent acts, which when examined are basically graffiti on the side of buildings or monuments. I'm wondering if you saw recently State Secretary Mike Pompeo's demand to expand the definition of human rights internationally by including property rights and, of course, religious liberty. But this sort of seems to be that trend in the Trump White House, that property damage and, you know, which goes back to the founding of this country, should be on the same level as what we think about in terms of human rights.
Yeah, I mean, there's a precedent for this. About 15 years ago in Oregon, there was something that people called the Green Scare, which was essentially a number of kind of environmental activists who were being charged with what amounts to arson and kind of vandalism and things like that, being charged with terrorism crimes. And the argument was that destruction to property, which is meant just to kind of, you know, cost money of corporations that they have an issue with or something like that, that should be at the level of terrorism. And they're passed the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act to help name that. And there's a number of kind of movements to basically say that this aggressive protesting, which is illegal and dangerous and all those things, that it also rises to the level of terrorism. But the reality is that how we understand terrorism is about loss of life and about the threats to actual communities, not, for example, the kind of property damage, even some of the escalated property damage and fire started and things like that have happened from protesters. It's just not the same thing as, for example, bombing the World Trade Center. It just doesn't live in the same world. But it's a rhetorical strategy, because when you label something as terrorism, all bets are off. Federal officers come in, heavy use of force, terrorism enhancements, heavy prosecutions, FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force investigations, the use of informants. There's a lot of things that start to happen when you shift how you talk about these protests and how you label them to terrorism.
And then just going back to what we started discussing in terms of journalism, because, of course, we wouldn't know about any of this and the details of it if it weren't for intrepid independent journalists, most of them unpaid, maybe some of them even untrained, going in with the most basic equipment like a smartphone to document this and then spread it on social media. Some newspapers and TV networks are even now buying footage from these independent journalists. The line between protester and journalist is also being blurred, right? There's people who consider themselves protesters first and journalists second, or perhaps even vice versa. And this is an interesting trend.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's also not a new trend. I mean, there's lots of movement journalism. There's been left-wing journalism. There's been political journalism. There's been activist journalism for years and years. One thing that's really important is that, you know, one, a lot of news organizations simply don't have the budgets to keep someone there all night. I mean, like, newspaper budgets have been slashed. TV budgets have been slashed. The other thing is that people who are kind of there in the center of things, that don't have like a crew with them and stuff like that, they blend in easier and they're easier to get footage and that kind of thing. And then what a lot of the news services are doing is basically contracting with those folks. Someone posts a video, they buy the video from, or they license it so they can put it into like a larger news report or a piece of analysis or something like that. And a lot of people are finding that, you know, maybe they came down there because they care about the issues that are at play, but then they also found that they really need another kind of camera on things. So they need to be interviewing people. They need to figure out what's going on. And it's all that kind of big swath of folks that are able to get us such a clear picture. And it really depends on those people who basically are just like, they have a Venmo on their Twitter and say, hey, if you can donate, that's great, because I'm going to be out here, you know, 15 hours Amazing. A day for the next 3 months.
Right. And many of them also know how to properly document these actions by ensuring that the identities of protesters are not revealed to authorities, who then, of course, will use that information if it's out there. Finally, Shane, you wrote a book about fascism, which we had interviewed you about a couple of years ago. It's Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. Many people feared when Trump came to power in 2016 that what we're seeing play out in Portland, you know, something to this effect, many people predicted that. Do you see this topic that we're discussing today very much consistent with what you feared would happen and what you've been writing about in terms of fascism today?
You know, a lot of what we talked about, a lot of what I talked about in the book, and a lot of what people talk about as neo-fascism is about what we kind of call minority movements. They're movements that don't have state power. So neo-Nazis, the Klan, things like that. They're not technically in control of the government. But right now we have a far-right political apparatus in the state that's literally moving state systems into an authoritarian direction to basically push partisan far-right political goals. And so I think we should be very, very scared about what the direction is that's happening here. And the next couple of months are going to be really informative, because the election's happening. Trump could even not accept the election results if he doesn't like them. There's a lot of things that could play out here. And when you think about what Robert Paxton calls the five stages of fascism, we're kind of seeing a move into basically using state services or state authorities as a way of challenging the core of liberal democratic values on which the country says it was built on.
Shane, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate having you on. We'll post a link to your new piece that we had been discussing. And I understand you also have some other pieces coming out in the Daily Beast that people can look for. Thanks so much and good luck to you.
Thanks for having me on.
My guest has been Shane Burley. He's a writer and filmmaker based in Portland, Oregon, and he's written the book Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. We've been discussing the deployment of Homeland Security officers to Portland, Oregon. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.